Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld had these famous axioms. He had three of them. There was there are known knowns, things that you know that you know. There are known unknowns, things that you know that you don't know. And then there are unknown unknowns, things that you don't know that you don't know. And he said that that last group was the most dangerous. But he never completed the quartet of the possible combinations. The final, in my opinion, the most dangerous one is there are unknown knowns, things that we know, but we choose to unknow.
Come on.
For some reason.
Come on.
Well, for some reason, and it may be a perfectly understandable reason, the American people have decided to unknow what they definitely knew about Donald Trump, right?
Well, let's help them unknow those things, shall we?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Just a quick lesson.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Over the next 4 years.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most but not all of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As I'm sure you know, last month, Disney-owned ABC News settled a ridiculous lawsuit against them by Donald Trump for some $15 million. And last week, it was reported, just before Trump was sworn into office again, that Paramount Global-owned CBS News was considering doing the same thing. More on all of that in a bit, but what you probably have not heard is that the newly Trump-led FCC has reopened previously dismissed complaints against ABC and CBS and NBC for those very same Trump grievances. A lot of good that settling, did you, ABC? The FCC, it seems, is now also being weaponized against Trump's political enemies. A guest who understands all of this much better than I joins me shortly, and Desi Doyen. We'll also have our latest Green News report a little bit later as well. Desiree,
yep.
How are you?
Doing all right.
But speaking of Des, yesterday, just before airtime, a new fire out here known as the Hughes Fire broke out. This one up in northern L.A. County. It sort of exploded, really, near the town of Castaic, not far from Six Flags Magic Mountain in Valencia. Yes, where all of those delicious Valencia oranges you may love come from. I've got a lot to get to today, and we'll have more on the GNR. But very quickly, Des, what is the latest on that quickly moving fire amid high winds and very dry conditions that had led to evacuation orders? I know after we got off the air yesterday for some 50,000 people and the closure of the major Interstate 5 in the area. Where are we today?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that it is not normal for California to have massive fires in January. Anybody who calls January peak fire season in California is lying to you.
Anybody you're talking about specifically?
Yeah, Rick Caruso, the former candidate for mayor of L.A., and a lot of other Republicans have been lying about that. So the Hughes fire so far, it grew to 10,000 acres. That's the equivalent of about 16 square miles in a single day. Firefighters are gaining ground against it. As we go to air, it's about 30% contained.
Good.
No structures have been damaged. They were able to keep the fire from spreading to the Castaic Reservoir's hydroelectric power plant, so that's important. Evacuation orders for dozens of zones have been lifted or downgraded, and there is some rain that is in the forecast.
What?
If it materializes, though, it will help, of course, fight the fires, but it also threatens to bring new dangers of mudslides and toxic runoff from burned homes and flame retardants getting swept into the watershed. So,
well,
yeah, there's that too.
Yeah, there is that. But rain here in Los Angeles?
I know.
Can't imagine such a thing. But I am looking forward to it. As noted, the area that that is burning, we're talking about, is where you get a lot of your food, like Valencia oranges and strawberries and much more lettuce and everything else. I saw photos last night of field workers picking strawberries amid that smoke from that fire, that Hughes fire, under orange skies. They were working amid those fires.
Keep that in mind when you go to the grocery store, please.
Without masks, by the way. Speaking of which, while they're working under those conditions so that you can have cheap strawberries and oranges and lettuce, from what is known as the nation's salad bowl out here in California. You're welcome. Many of those very same workers, according to reports last night, are now not showing up for work at all. Why is that? Well, as the New Republic reported on Wednesday, fear of increased raids by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, under Donald Trump, has already negatively affected the nation's agriculture sector, causing alarm that food prices could skyrocket in the near future as a result of Trump's aggressive immigration policies. Bakersfield, California, reportedly saw a massive drop-off in the number of field workers showing up for work beginning on Tuesday this week, the day after Trump was sworn in, while ICE agents in unmarked Chevy Suburbans rounded up and detained immigrants in the area, profiling individuals that they believed to be field workers, that according to Cal Matters. It has now already begun. The end result is acres of unpicked oranges roasting in the California sun at the height of the season. Bakersfield alone makes up a small portion of California's Central Valley, which produces approximately a quarter of the nation's food. Kern County, a couple of hours up the coast from where we are here in Southern California, where Bakersfield is located, has ranked within the top three agricultural counties in the nation for the last several years, largely off the backs of undocumented laborers, who are estimated to comprise more than half of the county's workforce, according to Cal Matters. Undocumented workers have reportedly already been targeted walking in and out of gas stations, getting breakfast at Home Depot, driving along the highway, leaving many with no other option than to simply stay home. Casey Creamer, president of the industry group California Citrus Mutual, told Cal Matters, quote, "We are in the middle of our citrus harvesting. This sent shockwaves through the entire community. People aren't going to work. Kids aren't going to school." Yesterday, he said about 25% of the workforce. Today, 75% didn't show up. Losing the bulk of America's agriculture workforce overnight is a recipe for, quote, absolute economic devastation, according to Richard Gerhardt, a professor of economics at Cal State Bakersfield. He spoke with the nonprofit news outlet. He said, quote, "You are talking about a recession level event if this new long-term norm continues." He said, arguing that the end result of Trump's policies will be felt in the grocery store checkout lines across America. The 47th president has effectively promised a full-throttle immigration crackdown for the next 4 years that includes attacking birthright citizenship and ordering high-profile ICE raids around the country against undocumented immigrants. So, yes, the very same people that are willing to work in the smoke amid wildfires as fires rage nearby so that you can enjoy those cheap, delicious strawberries and then bitch about it when the prices go up for them. Well, just 2 days into the administration, a new Republic reports, it appears that anti-immigration efforts will be a relative free-for-all. On Tuesday, the Department of Homeland Security announced it would roll back an Obama-era directive suddenly allowing the immigration agency to detain people in sensitive areas like hospitals, schools, places of worship, courtrooms, funerals, and weddings. A Trump DHS spokesperson said in a statement regarding that announcement, quote, criminals will no longer be able to hide in America's schools and churches to avoid arrest. Again, those criminals are the ones that are out there working for you amid wildfires. Quote, the Trump administration will not tie the hands of our brave law enforcement and instead trusts them to use common sense. Or they will issue complete blanket pardons to hundreds of them as long as they're Trump supporters who beat the living crap out of law enforcement officers at the U.S. Capitol trying to prevent who were trying to prevent Donald Trump from stealing the election in 2020. But why quibble? They're brave law enforcement who they're trusted to use common sense. A federal judge, speaking of birthright citizenship, a federal judge on Thursday, here's some good news, temporarily blocked Donald Trump's executive order redefining constitutional birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment, calling it, quote, blatantly unconstitutional during the first hearing in a multi-state effort challenging that order by the new president. U.S. District Judge John Coffenhauer repeatedly interrupted a Justice Department lawyer to ask how he could consider the order constitutional. When the attorney, Brett Shumate, said he'd like a chance to explain it in a full briefing, Coffenhauer told him this hearing was his chance. The temporary restraining order sought by Arizona, Illinois, Oregon, and Washington State was the first one to get a hearing before a judge, and it applies nationally. So Trump's attempt to undermine Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, the very first sentence of which reads pretty clearly, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. His attempt to undermine that, at least for the moment anyway, has been blocked for now by the federal courts. That case that was heard on Thursday is one of five lawsuits being brought by 22 different states and a number of immigrants' rights groups across the country. Suit includes personal testimonies from attorneys general who are U.S. citizens by birthright. And it names pregnant women who are afraid that their children will not become U.S. citizens. Coffenhauer, an 83-year-old Ronald Reagan appointee, he's the judge in the case, he grilled the DOJ attorneys, saying the order, quote, boggles the mind. Quote, this is a blatantly unconstitutional order, the judge told Shumate. The judge said he's been on the bench for more than four decades, and he could not remember seeing another case where the action challenged so clearly violated the Constitution. The DOJ attorney, said that he respectfully disagreed, and he asked for an opportunity to have a full briefing on the merits of the case rather than have a 14-day restraining order issued blocking its implementation. Arguing for the states, Washington's assistant AG said, quote, the executive order will impact hundreds of thousands of citizens nationwide who will lose their citizenship under this new rule. He added, births cannot wait, cannot be paused while the court considers this case. The DOJ later said in a statement that it will, quote, vigorously defend the president's executive order, which it said, quote, correctly interprets the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. that 14th Amendment was added to the U.S. Constitution just after the Civil War. So I guess it took about 150 years for a Department of Justice who had the courage to correctly interpret it for us. The department said, quote, "We look forward to presenting a full merits argument to the court and to the American people who are desperate to see our nation's law enforced." Oh, so now the Trump administration cares about enforcing the laws. Imagine that. That after Trump freed hundreds of violent felons and attempted cop killers onto the nation's streets on Monday night because, well, they agreed with Donald Trump politically. And they went along with his lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Other than that, we were desperate to see the nation's laws enforced. By the way, one of those people freed on Monday night with a long history of violence, even before January 6th, well, he was arrested the very next day in Florida on weapons charges. Go figure. Anyway, we'll need to get to that story on another day because Trump and his minions at the FCC are also hoping to undermine the First Amendment of the Constitution. You know, the one about free speech, the free speech that the Trumpers pretend to believe in and, you know, freedom of the press and all of that. Unfortunately, the FCC does not seem to be working for you anymore. They seem to be working for Donald Trump. That story with my guest John Bergmeier of Public Knowledge is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yes, they are. I know they ain't working for you. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right. Now, you may recall back in December, before the holidays, ABC News agreed to contribute $15 million toward Donald Trump's presidential library to settle a defamation lawsuit that Trump had filed over news anchor George Stephanopoulos's on-air assertion last year that the then president-elect had been, quote, found liable for rape and for defaming the victim of that rape, referencing the two civil cases that were won against Trump by writer E. Jean Carroll. Here's a short portion of Stephanopoulos's interview at the time with Congresswoman Nancy Mace of North Carolina, which became the subject of Trump's lawsuit against ABC and its corporate owner, the Disney Corporation.
You've endorsed Donald Trump for president.
Right.
Donald Trump has been found liable for rape by a jury. Donald Trump has been found liable for defaming the victim of that rape by a jury. It's been affirmed by a judge.
It was not a criminal court case.
I'm asking you a question about why you endorse someone who's been found liable for rape.
Now, the two cases in question referenced by the news anchor there had resulted in judgments against Trump of more than $88 million, though he is appealing both cases. Now, I don't think I need to go into the specific details on why Trump was specifically found guilty of sexual abuse in the first E. Jean Carroll trial against him rather than the charge of rape specifically under New York law, since it's a very graphic distinction that I don't believe I need to describe for purposes of this story. But in fact, the judge in the defamation case had made clear at the time that the difference between rape and sexual abuse in that case was a distinction essentially without a difference. Quote, "The finding that Ms. Carroll failed to prove that she was raped within the meaning of the New York penal law does not mean that she failed to prove that Mr. Trump raped her, as many people commonly understand the word rape. That was according to New York Judge Lewis Kaplan in one of his rulings back in July of 2023 when he added, quote, indeed, as the evidence at trial makes clear, the jury found that Mr. Trump, in fact, did exactly that. He explained that New York's legal definition of rape is, quote, far narrower, unquote, than the word is understood in, quote, common modern parlance. In other words, Stephanopoulos's on-air claim that Trump had been, quote, found liable for rape and that he defamed, quote, the victim of that rape was utterly defensible from a First Amendment aspect, as other media outlets and constitutional experts noted at the time in their somewhat stunned response to ABC's $15 million settlement with the by then incoming president. Trump was also enraged and called for ABC News' broadcast license to be revoked following the presidential debate between him and Vice President Harris, thanks to the debate moderators from ABC News daring to fact-check some of his most outrageously false statements, such as this one that you may recall.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
I just want to clarify here. You bring up Springfield, Ohio, and ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there had been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community.
Well, I've seen people on television. Let me just say,
or this one.
They have abortion in the ninth month. And her vice presidential pick says abortion in the ninth month is absolutely fine. He also says execution after birth, it's execution, no longer abortion, because the baby is born, is okay.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born. Madam Vice President, I want to get your response to President Trump.
Outrageous. That was ABC News. Then last week, news broke that executives at Paramount Global, which owns CBS News, well, they were in settlement talks themselves with the Trump legal team for another seemingly ridiculous lawsuit filed by the litigious felon, in which he claimed that 60 Minutes deceptively edited an interview with his then presidential campaign rival, Kamala Harris. CBS, for its part, has responded that the lengthy interview was edited to fit into a 21-minute time slot on a program where Trump himself had been invited to sit for an interview but canceled at the last minute. And Trump has also gone after NBC over Harris's appearance on Saturday Night Live in the run-up to Election Day, charging that he should have been afforded equal time, even as he, by the way, had actually hosted an entire episode of the comedy program during his first run for president back during the 2016 campaign, as he has since gone on to call for broadcast licenses to be revoked for all three of the broadcast networks. At the same time, supporters of his had been filing complaints with the Federal Communications Commission, echoing Trump's various gripes, despite what appears to be, in all of these cases, very clear-cut cases of First Amendment press freedoms. Last week, before Trump was sworn into his second term of office, Jessica Rosenworcel, the Democratic-appointed chair of the FCC under President Biden, dismissed the claims against those networks, arguing that they sought, quote, to curtail freedom of the press. Quote, the action we take makes clear two things, Rosenworcel said. First, the FCC should not be the president's speech police. Second, the FCC should not be journalism's censor-in-chief. Nonetheless, on Wednesday this week, after Donald Trump was sworn in for his second term, as the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Press reported, Trump's new FCC chair, Brendan Carr, had reversed Rosenworcel's dismissals of three cases against the three network outlets and news broadcasters. The three FCC complaints in question were all filed by the so-called Center for American Rights, a right-wing nonprofit law firm. In a statement released on Wednesday, John Bergmeier, the legal director at Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group, which describes itself as defending consumer rights in the emerging digital culture, decried the new Trump FCC chair's decision, quote, when former chairwoman Rosenworcel dismissed a number of complaints concerning broadcasters in the final days of her term. She stated that the FCC should not be the president's speech police and should not be journalism's censor-in-chief. This, says Bergmeier, is a far cry from Chairman Carr's reported actions in reinstating just those complaints that suit his partisan agenda. Chairman Carr has made it plain that he intends to weaponize the FCC to threaten political speech and news coverage that he disagrees with. Joining us now is attorney John Bergmeier of publicknowledge.org. Mr. Bergmeier, thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you.
I know that you guys are fighting on many fronts at once at Public Knowledge right about now, and I also want to ask you something, some troubling concerns and recent news regarding the FCC's ability to enforce net neutrality. But let me start with this disturbing decision by Trump's new FCC chair on Wednesday. First, what grounds and on what basis was the new chair able to reopen cases previously dismissed by the Biden-led FCC?
Yeah, just in general, the chair of the FCC or a bureau has like a certain amount of time by rule where once they issue something, they can just recall it with little explanation. And if the previous occupant of the office takes an action that is too soon to their last day, then that just sort of like rolls over to the new chairman. So it's really just because it was done sort of at the last minute, mm-hmm. down to the wire, that provided that opportunity for the new chair to reverse what Chairwoman Rosenworcel had done.
Wow. Well, oops, I guess. As I noted in the intro, it seems like the basis for all three of these complaints run wildly afoul of First Amendment rights to free speech and freedom of the press. Now, I am not an attorney. You are. Am I on base or off base there?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's definitely true that broadcasters who use the public airwaves are held to a higher public interest standard than other kinds of speaker. And that's sort of justified on the basis that there's only a certain number of broadcast licenses to go around. So we have mm-hmm. to make sure they serve the public. And that's been the basis for a lot of requirements that, say, broadcasters have that other forms of media don't, whether it's, you know, requirements that to provide children's programming and things like that. They provide local weather, you know, they're supposed to serve their communities, and they have a higher obligation. But at the same time, we of course have a First Amendment. So while we do have certain rules in place to that do restrict broadcasters to an extent, they usually are not interpreted or applied in a way that targets like core First Amendment activity. So here the complaints are really, one is a violation, an alleged violation of the FCC's equal time rule. Now, equal time rule doesn't mean like stations are obligated to give like equal time to like all sides of an issue or anything like that. The equal time rule states that when a candidate appears on TV and it's not part of the news, so an interview doesn't count, news coverage doesn't count, paid advertisements don't count, things like that. Mm-hmm. But if a candidate who's a registered candidate appears on TV, the broadcaster is supposed to give an equal opportunity to other candidates to appear. So the complaint was by Kamala Harris appearing on SNL. This violated equal time because that wasn't mm-hmm. news coverage. But I believe the station did end up giving, NBC did end up giving then candidate Trump time on the network in another forum. So I just don't even think factually, you know, there's much of a basis for that. And then the other complaints are about something called news distortion, which again is very hard to prove. And that would be if a station is like deliberately lying in order to deceive the public. It's sort of like how in the US we have things like defamation law, but particularly against a public figure, it's often very hard to prove defamation because you can't just prove that they're wrong or you disagree with them or they're being unfair or mean to me. You have to prove that they're like actively deciding, you know, to harm me through like conscious deception. And that's a very hard standard to meet. I don't think that any of these cases meet the very tough requirements, you know, for the FCC, you know, to decide in the complainant's favor. And it's really notable that Chairman Carr did not reinstate a complaint that was against a Fox affiliate in Philadelphia that was based on the Fox affiliate airing information that it knew that it was adjudged to be defamatory with regard to some of those cases. So, you know, it really is a troubling sign that the current chairman views, you know, these regulatory tools as a means to advance his cultural and partisan agenda.
Now, explain, if you could, John Bergmeier, the structure of the FCC and how, if I understand it correctly, it's chaired by an appointee of the sitting president, or of at least the sitting president's party. But isn't it supposed to be an independent agency, not under the direction of that president?
Correct. Yeah. Every commissioner on the FCC is appointed by the president. And that also, by the way, includes, you know, the president typically will appoint the members of the other party. So, for example, Brendan Carr, I think he was appointed by Joe Biden. And usually there can't be more than three members of the commission that are the same political party as the president.
Okay.
So, and then the president just names of who currently is a commissioner, one of them to be the chair. And you're right, it is supposed to be an independent agency. The president does get to pick the chair. And the way it works, typically commissioners resign to give the current president the ability to appoint a majority of independent commissions, even when their terms sort of seem to overlap into the next administration.
Now, I know that it's still early in the process, as the complaints against these three networks were just restored yesterday, I believe. Though that came just 2 days after the new president was sworn in. And it seems to me it sort of offers a very clear signal of how this commission will be operated in the Trump era. But what do you glean from, what should we take from Chairman Carr's reopening of these particular cases, even as I understand that, you know, you mentioned there was others that were not reopened by the new chair regarding Fox? Does it give us a signal politically here about what this committee will do? Or is this just a matter of, well, he's only got a certain amount of time to reverse a previous chair's decision?
You know, I don't know that we need to be looking for to this action for a signal, because he's stated his intentions loud and clear to the press and in speeches and statements.
Chairman Carr has done that already?
Chairman Carr, exactly. Okay. Yeah, that he intends to, you know, in his words, you know, hold broadcasters to their public interest obligations. So I believe that this is just sort of in keeping with his previously announced intentions. And what's particularly disturbing is, as you know, the chairman, you know, wants to pick fights with the First Amendment rights of broadcasters, or use dubious theories of law to go after, you know, perceived slights on big tech. Although, you know, maybe that's changing now that big tech is so cozy with the Trump administration, unlike the last time. Meanwhile, the FCC has just lost its basic authority to regulate broadband. And there's just like any number of things that the FCC should be doing in terms of protecting consumers or just promoting competition in the communications marketplace that it's not doing, because the new chair seems more consumed with getting headlines on conservative media.
And I assume he's gone beyond saying that he intends to enforce public interest obligations, because that I would be in favor of that, at least if you phrase it that way. Now, by the way, I you know, have an interest here myself. The Project 2025 manifesto specifically targets Pacifica Radio, which many Pacifica affiliates run the broadcast, obviously. So I have some interest there. But enforcing public interest obligations, sure, I got no problem with that. He has, I assume, gone farther in his indications about how he plans to run the FCC.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps in my spoken remarks, the ironic quotation marks weren't as visible as I would like, but I would view, you know, that's the legal phrase he'll use. That's the source of authority. But I think, of course, his view of what is in the public interest would be very different from mine. And I would say really very different from then Congress's and the history of public interest, because it's not just some vague term like, oh, whatever is in the public interest, I get to just decide. You know, Congress, when it passed the Communications Act, basically told the FCC, you know, when it was creating the FCC, its purpose was to create, you know, a fast, rapid, high-speed communication network for all Americans. Mm-hmm. And I would say that to the extent that the public interest means something for the FCC, you know, it has to be aimed at creating a fair, universally accessible, equitable communication system. That's what Congress's directive was. And it's not just, you know, I think that this particular network is using its First Amendment rights in ways that I disagree with. Because, right. you know, guess what? There are plenty of networks out there and broadcasters that use their First Amendment rights in ways that I disagree with too. But I don't, you know, go around marshaling the power of the state to punish them for it.
Yeah, the power of the federal government in this case. Right. I know the political pendulum, it swings back and forth on the FCC. As, you know, chairs of different parties take over control under various presidents. But all of these claims by Donald Trump against these networks, the ones we've talked about so far in this segment, they seem very cut and dry cases. First Amendment, free speech, freedom of the press. And so to even pretend, which is why it was so maddening to see, you know, somebody like ABC News agreeing to settle that eminently winnable case, it seems to me. But have we seen previous FCCs, previous commissions under other presidents allow cases like this to move forward, or is this something different?
You know, there are cases that are brought against broadcasters for not complying with their public interest obligations or for other things. And, you know, and sometimes it happens with under Republicans and Democrats. You know, even under Ajit Pai, you know, Trump's previous FCC chairman, mm-hmm. he ended up sanctioning Sinclair Broadcasting because they had engaged in systematic misrepresentations of a deal they're trying to get the FCC to push through. And even that, you know, pushed him too far. I think the issue is less whether or not these would ultimately win in court. What would a judge say? What, you know, what will the process be? But it's just the very threat and the delay. The fact that the FCC, for spurious reasons, could hold up, you know, a routine license renewal by a broadcaster, or it could make, you know, some other transaction they're involved in more difficult, tends to get entities that are subject to that to just, you know, figure out how to play ball, how to make it go away. Mm. And I think that's what we saw with the settlement on the defamation case that you've discussed. And, you know, I'd be worried about a similar dynamic here where, you know, some voluntary, quote unquote, changes are made because, you know, the media corporations, you know, they have less of an interest in sort of going to the mat for the First Amendment every opportunity and more about just sort of promoting their bottom line.
Yeah, particularly as they're owned by large companies like Disney or Paramount that have other interests before the federal government. Yeah. I suspect that if it was ABC News, if ABC News was independently owned, they might have fought that case. Same with CBS and so forth. But, you know, the news divisions don't make money. Theme parks and major corporate mergers do. Now, by the way, Trump has said over and over again that the news operations at ABC, NBC, CBS should have their licenses revoked. But news operations, I want to clarify this, John, and please help me. News operations themselves are not actually licensed, to my knowledge.
That's correct.
There's no license that they can take away. What actual licenses is he even referring to when you hear Trump say, oh, they ought to have their licenses taken away?
Yeah, for the most part, the licenses just refer to broadcast licenses just for, you know, beaming electromagnetic radiation into the air. That requires a license. Sometimes these companies, in addition to, you know, the spectrum they broadcast over, you know, they might have other licenses for satellite uplinks and things like that. But yeah, it is really just the hook of needing to use the airwaves. And the fact that, you know, that does have to be regulated more just because of the nature of the resource that gives them the opportunity to make these otherwise baseless threats.
By the way, who is this? I want to ask you about net neutrality, but quickly, who is this Center for American Rights? Are you familiar with? They filed all three of the cases that were reopened by Carr on Wednesday. Do you have any idea who these people are?
No, I mean, these groups, you know, they pop up, they go away. I've never heard of this one. You know, there's another one that I'm dealing with now regarding the Universal Service Program, where the conservative group in question is called Consumers Research. You know, so these generically named organizations, look, I'm sure maybe they say that about the progressive ones, but, you know, at least we've been around for a while.
Now, earlier this month, the Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which can be a right-leaning court, announced a decision which essentially blocks, as I understand it, and pardon me for my sort of layman description here, but it essentially blocks, as I understand it, the FCC's ability to assure an open internet through net neutrality regulations, essentially assuring that, you know, everyone has the same access to all websites and, for example, that they can access bradblog.com just as easily as they can access google.com, that roadblocks cannot be built into net access, that companies can't charge more to access some sites or charge site owners to make sure that users can visit them, etc. But if I'm understanding this decision correctly, the Sixth Circuit has actually reversed or removed the FCC's ability to assure net neutrality. Am I understanding that in general correctly?
Yeah, they basically said that the statute that the FCC was relying on as their source of authority over broadband doesn't mean what they think it means, and that broadband can't be regulated as telecommunications, which is how the legal authority the FCC uses to regulate things like the phone network. And instead, it's in this loose category called information services, which is just sort of like a catch-all for things like websites and just, you know, the things that you use telecommunications to access. You know, it's because of the way that the FCC has regulated the phone network as a common carrier system that, you know, like pizza analogies always come up in this context. But if you just call up your local pizza shop, it goes to your local pizza shop. In other words, the phone network can't cut a special deal with like Domino's or Papa John to make it so that, you know, no, they have like a you know, an officially approved, you know, pizza partner. No, they just connect you to the call you want. And net neutrality is, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of details different because the networks are different, was the principle that the internet should mostly work along the same lines, that, you know, you're the user, you decide what you want to see. And it's the purpose of the broadband ISP to just sort of provide you what you've asked for. And what the court has done here is said, no, FCC, you can't do that. This was in light. This was sort of following after the Supreme Court got rid of something called the Chevron doctrine, which was previously agencies had the ability, when a statute was considered ambiguous, then the agency could decide what it means. Back in the early 2000s, the George W. Bush FCC decided that broadband would be an information service. The Supreme Court said, oh, it's ambiguous, FCC, you just get to decide either way. And now without Chevron, the Sixth Circuit has said, no, when we're looking at the statute, we just think it means this thing and only this thing. And every FCC who has said something different is wrong. And so,
even though the FCC has sort of gone back and forth on the issue of net neutrality and whether they, you know, must maintain it or not, whether broadband communications outlets must maintain it, what the court is now saying is it's not even up to you guys. It's not even up to the FCC. None of your business. We'll decide.
Yeah, so you have the policy question, what's good policy? And then it's like, well, what's legal for the agency to do? Because agencies need to have some flexibility. Judges, just because they think something is bad policy, shouldn't be able to just overturn an agency just because they think they got the facts wrong or something. But instead, nope, we have judges just sort of setting up shop for themselves, just rewriting basic aspects of communications law. And the reason why this one is so frustrating is, you know, Justice Antonin Scalia, he dissented from when the Supreme Court allowed the Bush FCC to classify as an information service. He said, look, I'm reading the statute and it's unambiguously necessarily a telecommunications service. And in fact, other judges and other courts that looked at the issue before the FCC got involved, none of them ever said it was an information service. And yet now, you know, fast forward, the plain and unambiguous reading that no one else can possibly come to is decided to be that the FCC has no authority at all. So it's not just the fact that I disagree with the policy. It's just the sheer intellectual dishonesty of claiming that a statute unambiguously means something that really, until that became like the political cause, no independent court had ever looked at it and said, oh, yeah, that's the best reading. And the result is it's not just net neutrality. It's the basis of the FCC's authority over all aspects of broadband.
Right.
So making sure that in that, you know, people in apartments can have competitive choices of ISPs, mm-hmm. and, you know, making sure that, you know, telecommunications providers who are competitors can access utility poles, like a lot of like boring stuff like that. That's nevertheless really necessary for the functioning of the network also depends on the FCC having the authority. So everyone talks about net neutrality. Net neutrality is a huge political football. You know, in the meantime, the FCC just doesn't have the legal tools it needs to do what's supposed to be its job. And instead, you know, the incoming administration just wants to, you know, waste time on political footballs.
And I will add, it's not just the FCC, by the way. This Chevron deference is going to affect all sorts of executive agencies like that, all kinds of questions like this, where you're going to see courts coming in now. Following the Supreme Court's ruling on this, on the Chevron deference, and saying, nope, this is not up to you. This is not up to the experts at the, you know, the Health and Human Services. This is now up to the courts, essentially, to decide how they want this to go. Very quickly, John, would you expect the Trump administration's FCC to appeal this ruling? It's Ohio Telecom versus FCC. Are they going to appeal it?
I doubt it. I think they're pretty happy with this outcome. So it's really remains to be seen. You know, I think that the current status of the FCC having like little to no authority over broadband is not really sustainable. But nevertheless, that's where we're at.
And where we're at is maybe the end of net neutrality.
Unfortunately, it's, you know, it's definitely been, a lot of setbacks on this issue, but thankfully the way that the FCC took, said we don't have authority, at least it did open up room for the states to regulate, and that has been upheld. So we're looking at states like, California that have pretty strong net neutrality rules, and we're hoping, you know, in the absence of federal authority, more states step in.
Yes. At least until they, say, nope, it's not up to you states. What states' rights? No, all of a sudden we don't care about that. Yikes. Yep. Anyway, thank you so much. Very helpful, very clarifying on all of these issues. John Bergmeier, I hope you don't mind if we bother you again in the near future to help us make sense of some of these tricky legal issues. John Bergmeier is the legal director at publicknowledge.org, the Washington-based public interest group to working to defend consumer rights in the emerging digital culture. You can find them at publicknowledge.org or on the Twitters and hopefully Blue Sky at Public Knowledge. Thanks for joining us today, John. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you so much.
You bet. Okay. Let's take a quick break here. And Desi Doyen, you ready with your Green News Report?
Yeah. I was just thinking about how we have a multi-front fight in front of us on all of these once established norms and traditions and rights and stuff, and it's going to take a long time to rebuild all of it if we get the chance.
It is, and you know, you say multi-front fight, and I'm thinking multi doesn't really say enough.
No.
Is there a, I don't know if there's a larger word
colossal,
for multi.
Yeah, I don't know.
Colossal mess is what we've got. Well, speaking of colossal messes, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. That is straight ahead on your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Hey, speaking of colossal messes, Desi Doyen, a little bit of breaking news as we took our break there. Actually, let's get to our GNR, and then I'll come back with that. We will close with that. But first, it is our latest Green News Report.
From Texas to Florida, the South is snowed in, and the situation is dangerous.
Unprecedented blizzard warning and record snowstorm shuts down the South.
We have seen the wind really push this fire as it exploded in just a matter of hours.
New wildfire and evacuations in LA County as Donald Trump spews delusional lies about California. Plus, last year, the U.S. saw 27 different billion-dollar weather and climate disasters.
All of that disastrous news and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Yeah, we had a little fire out here. I don't know if you heard about that. Local story. For all the people who sent me a text, stay safe. Thank you so much, because I was about to run right toward the flames. And then I saw your text and did. That was very helpful.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I thought the fires out here in Los Angeles were all but over, but before we get there, snowstorms in Florida and New Orleans?
Yes, it is surprising. At least 9 people have died from a massive snowstorm wreaking havoc on parts of the southeast this week that dumped record snowfall in weird places that are not equipped for snow, including the first ever blizzard warning for coastal Louisiana. Hundreds of thousands without power, widespread transportation disruptions, a record-shattering 10 inches of snow in New Orleans, 9 inches of snow in Florida. That's nearly double the previous state record.
10 inches of snow in New Orleans.
Yep. And there is a climate component. UCLA climate scientist Dr. Daniel Swain explained on social media that big snowstorms require not just cold air, but also ample moisture provided by unusually warm ocean waters. That's thanks to man-made climate change. In Los Angeles County, extreme drought, 50-mile-an-hour wind gusts, and extremely low humidity sparked another major fire this week. The Hughes Fire in the northern part of L.A. County exploded in just hours, burning at a rate of 23 football fields a minute. 50,000 people evacuated. The Hughes Fire is one of 6 major fires burning in Southern California, in part due to a record rain deficit. No rain since May. A new study in the journal Nature finds that man-made climate change is contributing to weather whiplash in the Los Angeles region, periods of torrential rains followed by extremely dry tinderbox conditions.
I am feeling it.
On Tuesday, new President Donald Trump issued an executive order for California directing federal agencies to override the state's recently negotiated water allocation rules, which have widespread support among cities, tribes, Central Valley agriculture groups, and commercial fisheries. Experts say Trump's new order will have zero effect on water supplies in Los Angeles. But on Tuesday, Trump repeated his bizarre opinions about California's water.
Los Angeles has massive amounts of water available to it. All they have to do is turn the valve. And that's the valve coming back from and down from the Pacific Northwest. Millions of gallons of water, and they turned it off. It's off now.
Oh, the Pacific Northwest valve.
But there is no valve, no spigot, as California Governor Gavin Newsom has been trying to explain for months.
We have no spigot that we can go and move as he keeps. I mean, I think he actually believes it.
Yeah.
Because I've been hearing this for 6 or 7 years.
I think he actually does believe it because, as you say, he's delusional.
The L.A. fires and the southeastern blizzard are the first billion-dollar disasters of 2025. Those are weather disasters costing at least $1 billion in damages. Last year, according to NOAA, the U.S. saw 27 individual billion-dollar weather and climate disasters that killed nearly 600 Americans. Last year's tally was second only to 2023.
And when we say billion-dollar disasters, that means at least $1 billion.
Yes, total cost of those 27 disasters last year was $183 billion, the fourth highest price tag on record.
But we can't afford to do anything about climate change.
But there is a bright spot. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the oil industry's appeal of a lawsuit filed by the city of Honolulu that aims to hold 15 major oil and gas companies liable for millions of dollars in damage linked to climate
climate change caused by the burning of the oil industry's product. The denial is a major win for communities working to hold big oil accountable for decades of deception about climate science, and the ruling could pave the way for other lawsuits filed by local governments and states against polluters to go forward in court.
When the bright spot is the U.S. Supreme Court, you know we are in 2025. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't you think it's weird?
Yeah, I think it's weird. I think it's all really, really, really weird. And
yep.
Yet we are stuck with it anyway. Speaking of stuck with it, Pete Hegseth, the Fox News morning show weekend host, who is apparently a public drunkard, according to dozens of sources at this point, had a test vote, if you will, in the U.S. Senate. Only two Republicans were willing to vote against his nomination to become the next Secretary of Defense. That would be Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Good for them. There would still have to be at least two more Republicans to show a backbone to stand up to this nonsense before Hegseth can be blocked. But late today, it looks like CNN has the breaking news. President Trump's nominee to lead the Pentagon paid $50,000 to a woman alleging sexual assault, according to documents obtained by CNN. I presume that's the same case that has been referred to as a rape case. The woman went to a hospital seeking a rape kit. The medical professionals there then contacted law enforcement about all of this. Hegseth is said to have settled in a secret settlement with this woman, paid her some amount of money, didn't tell the Trump transition team about any of this.
Such good vetting.
Theoretically, by the way,
oh,
I'm not even convinced he didn't tell him about it, but theoretically didn't tell him about it. Didn't disclose how much he paid her off to keep quiet about all of this. Apparently that number is $50,000. Now, they haven't had the final vote yet on Hegseth's confirmation to become Secretary of Defense. I wonder if that will shake out two more Republicans willing to stand up, for crying out loud, for a guy to block his nomination to head the largest organization in the world, the U.S. Pentagon, 3 million employees.
Yes, and if you have an opinion on whether or not you would like this unqualified and disqualified guy to be the Secretary of Defense, do call your representatives. Call your senators. They love to hear from you.
Specifically senators right now, because
yes,
those are the ones who are voting.
Yes, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121.
At the same time, by the way, Donald Trump is reportedly moving to close down the Pentagon office that is focused on the prevention of civilian deaths resulting from U.S. military activity.
Brilliant.
What do we need them for? All right. Got to get out. My thanks again to our guest today, John Bergmeier of publicknowledge.org, to Desi Doyen, our producer, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We greatly appreciate it. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. You can drop me email. I'm always happy to hear from you. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at the Brad Blog. But feel free to bother Desi. She is Green News Report.
Yes, come by.
That's it. We'll see you at all of the above until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Don't you think it's weird?